You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Morning, everybody. Pressing on in Mark. We're not going to read every verse in that stretch, but quite a few. Our topic is faith, really. We're going to be going through episodes in Jesus' life that teach us about faith. Now, I don't know what you think or associate with the word faith. I know when I think about faith, this is what I see. My 2002 Toyota Camry. It is actually in 3 more years, it will be an antique. And I would get in this thing and drive to Alaska right now. It is that reliable. This is the most trustworthy vehicle I have ever owned. I have complete faith in it. It's never left me on the side of the road. I think if there was a word that I would say is the closest synonym to faith, it's something like trust, something like that. Now, instead of like really burrowing down into what this means immediately, I'd like to take kind of a high altitude view and skim through some episodes in Jesus' life with this topic in mind, asking these two questions. First, what kind of faith pleases Jesus? Like when Jesus is looking for faith, what kind of faith would he respond to? And then another related question is what makes Jesus himself, when we think about all the things that we can trust, why him? What makes him a worthy object of our faith? Okay, so that's pretty much it. Episode number one, the big storm. Okay, so if you read the last part of Mark 4, Jesus and his disciples get in a boat and they're headed for this area on the southeast coast of the Sea of Galilee called Gadara, or the land of the Gerasenes. Now, it says, as soon as they took off, there arose a fierce gale, literally a great storm of wind. And we know that in this region today, this actually does happen. This is what the Sea of Galilee looks like on a good day. And you can see it's in a deep valley, which really funnels the wind, and big windstorms can whip up very quickly. I was actually on this body of water in a motorboat last year with my family and another family. We had rented this boat. We were out, you know, cruising for about 20 minutes, and the motor died. It's flat out died. We tried and tried, couldn't start it. Cell phone worked, thank God. Couldn't walk on water back to shore. So we're sitting there waiting for the boat they should have rented us to show up and tow us back in. And on the way back, the owner of the rental company sat in our boat and told us about life on the water in this area. It was so great just to hang out with him. And we asked him about the storms, and he said, oh yeah, they do have these storms. This is damage from one of the more recent ones, just flattening things, just wind out of nowhere. And so not a good time to be on the water. And at this point, you know, the waves are breaking, the boat's filling with water, wind's whipping, you know, it's just super treacherous conditions. Somehow Jesus in the stern is sleeping on a cushion. The idea that we even know that his head was on a pillow, that's the kind of detail an eyewitness would give you. Yeah, somehow he sleeps. Of course, the disciples, very, very alarmed. I mean, there a lot of them are seasoned fishermen, but they were very worried about this. So they woke him up and said, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" You know, and he's like, you know, you're here, we're in this terrible thing, I can't believe you're snoozing through all this. And then it says Jesus did something absolutely incredible. He did not say a word to his disciples. Instead, he spoke to to nature. He rebuked the wind and said to the waves, quiet, be still. He said, hush, and nature obeyed. The wind died down and it was completely calm. That is unbelievable. Just to be with somebody who can literally not just cast out a demon, not just heal a fever, not just send a paralytic walking out of the room, but tell nature to shush. That is a level of power that these guys had never seen before. And he had a question for them. He was like, and this is really what we're getting at. Why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith? Jesus is saying, aren't I a legitimate object of faith? You've seen me heal people. You've seen me cast out these demons. You've seen a lot of things, amazing things that I've done. Why would you doubt that I could do this as well? No faith. That was the problem in this boat. Plenty of evidence that Jesus was capable of doing something. But when in the face of this kind of powerful storm, their faith, it wasn't there. They just absolutely had no faith. It says, and this is strange, after the storm died down, it says they became afraid and said to one another, who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Isn't that interesting? They're safe and now they're afraid. Why is that? Well, I think it's because of the power that they just witnessed. This is described as a great storm in verse 37 that became a great calm. And the juxtaposed in this, what Mark is saying is it was really bad and then the sea was glass like that. And that just over-the-top demonstration of power from someone that you're right next to is scary. It's intimidating. That's why they were afraid. They're like, who is this guy? Who is Jesus really? Who could actually tell nature to chill out? And that's a key question. How do you view Jesus? Who is he? What is he capable of? I wonder if we fully appreciated who he is, if it might be easier to trust him and put our faith in him. And so, yeah, what kind of faith is he looking for? Not the kind of faith that was lacking in this boat, that's for sure. This is basically kind of a way to set up, this is not the kind of faith Jesus has in mind. Now, the next, actually, there is another episode that follows this. After this, Jesus continues across the water to the destination they were headed to. They heal this guy who was possessed by multiple demons. It's in the beginning of Mark 5. It's a crazy story. We're going to skip it because we don't have time. But after that whole thing, they take off again and head back home to their home base in the town of Capernaum. And at that point, we're going to see a couple more pretty powerful healings. And so we pick it up. Jesus crosses over again in the boat to the other side, again headed to the kind of the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee where the town of Capernaum is. And like you'd expect, there's a crowd gathering as they see him coming in the distance as he steps off the boat. A large crowd gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. Okay, so this is typical of Jesus. I mean, literally everywhere this man goes, he's got people following him. And I don't know if you've been to the Sea of Galilee, but it's, imagine a big lake in the bottom of a cereal bowl. Okay, the whole thing is like a giant amphitheater. You can pretty much see across the lake from most vantage points. So the idea that people could kind of see Jesus coming and run over to get ready for him, that totally fits the geography of this place. And so they're there, a big crowd has gathered around him, anticipating, you know, just wanting to connect with him. And among them is a leader in the community. It says, one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up. Okay, so this guy here, this could be trouble. If you remember, Jesus is attracting larger and larger and larger crowds. Where are they coming from? Well, they're coming from the influence of the religious leaders in the area who are realizing Jesus is becoming a rising voice that people are turning to. And because of this, guys like this official of the synagogue, this literally, he's a ruler of the synagogue, the place of Jewish worship. Guys like him were very upset with Jesus. There was a lot of tension. There were all kinds of, derisive comments and public challenges against Jesus. Lots of tension. Makes you wonder what he's going to do. And we read, surprisingly, on seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet. Literally, this guy gets down on his knees. This ruler of the synagogue gets down on his knees before Jesus. And then he lays out his concern. He implored Jesus earnestly, saying, "My little daughter." And we know from Luke, this was his only child. "My one and only child, my little daughter, is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she'll get well and live." And so it's, I remember when our kids were at home, when they would just have a fever. I remember the pit in my stomach I felt. And this guy's watching his little girl slip away. And there's no plan B. There's nowhere he can go. Jesus, and maybe this is kind of a reluctant thing too, as somebody who's part of a religious establishment that's hostile to Jesus, maybe this is the last thing he would want to do, go to Jesus, but Jesus was his only hope. And so here he is on his knees pleading with him. And you just have to realize, think about Jesus. He doesn't owe Jairus anything. Guys like Jairus, they've accused Jesus of blasphemy. They've called him demon-possessed. We know from the beginning of chapter 3 that as Jairus was there kneeling in front of Jesus, his associates were plotting to kill him. You can think of a lot of things that Jairus could have heard from Jesus. He could have been like, so I get it. When things are good, you guys go after me. But when your back's to the wall, you're on your knees asking for my help. I see how this works. Jesus could have said that. He could have said, if you're the one who's tight with God, if you're so right with God, why don't you go heal your daughter yourself? He would have been completely justified in saying that, but he doesn't say that. What he does is, without hesitation, Jesus goes off with him. He's like, "Your daughter's sick. Let's go. Let's heal her." That's what he does. And it says a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. Okay, so there's this huge group of people. Jesus says he's going to go heal him. And that's where we're at. Now, I said that as we go through here, we're gonna ask these questions. What about Jesus as an object of our faith? And what is faith, the kind of faith he approves of? Well, here's a thing that we see about what Jesus is like. He's gracious. I think a lot of us, it's easy to assume, if I've been away from God long enough, and I've screwed up frequently enough, that I could never expect a gracious reception from God. But what we're doing when we think like that is we're projecting our own vindictiveness, our own shortcomings onto God. Jesus isn't like that. Jesus is always ready, no matter how many steps we've taken away from him, to immediately receive us back. That's the picture. Jesus, unlike us, is unbelievably gracious. That's what we're seeing with, with this guy, Jairus. And what kind of faith is Jesus looking for? What's his bar that we have to clear when you think about the kind of faith that he would respond to? Well, I think what we're seeing with Jairus is undeniable. I don't know how else to describe it. This is foxhole faith. You know, foxhole faith, what is that? You know, the mortars are exploding, the shrapnel's flying, life's just out of control. And in my desperation, I pray to a God I never talk to otherwise and ask him to help. And that is precisely how Jairus is treating Jesus. Just only in his moment of his need does he come and seek him for help. And so you'd think, you know, I think a lot of us, we look at foxhole faith kind of like, yeah, whatever. That's just so weak. But Jesus, for him, he accepts it. Jairus didn't have much. He just had a little bit of trust that maybe Jesus could heal his daughter too. It was self-motivated. It was limited. He was probably there reluctantly, but Jesus said, that's good enough. Let's go. That's something to think about when we think about, is there some titanic standard for faith? It doesn't look like it. Foxhole faith was enough. So here's a scene, the whole crowd there to see a healing in the first place. Community leader comes up, daughter's about to die. Jesus says, let's do this. Everyone's like, yes, let's go. You know, the ambulance is pulling out of the parking lot. There's the rescue run all the way to Jairus' house. But before they can even get anywhere, everything comes to a screeching halt. A woman shows up who had a hemorrhage for 12 years. This woman had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. Okay, so Jairus was desperate, but here's someone else breaking into this whole scene, equally desperate. It says that she had a hemorrhage, some kind of chronic bleeding condition, maybe a uterine problem. We don't know for sure. And like some of us here, this was not just a flash. It was a persistent condition, a life-changing condition. It was the kind of thing that wasn't going to go away. Brutal to have something like this for this long. You know, we actually have accounts of people with conditions like this from first century contemporary writers, from Jewish writers. And they had physicians like we do. But the treatments they used, like, you know, one involves the ashes of an ostrich egg, okay, just to give you a sense of what these treatments were like. Some of the treatments were just savage. I mean, they were tragic. Just what this woman undoubtedly went through was horrible. And sadly, even though these treatments were ineffective, they still cost money. And she spent every penny she had trying to get better. And in the end, it was just the opposite. She got worse. So you can't think of somebody who's in a more desperate condition than this woman. She has no support, no help, isolated by the condition that she has. And instead of it getting better, instead of any hope that it's going to improve, it got worse. And now she, like this Jairus guy, and like a lot of us when life throws us a curveball, is on her knees trying to figure out what to do. Well, it says, after hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him. So she's trying to stay out of sight, just sneaking up to touch his cloak. They thought back then that power in a healer often was concentrated in their clothing. And so she goes to Jesus trying to just brush the hem of his garment. And she's thinking, if I can pull that off, I'll get well. And so when you think about these two people, Just, and I think they're deliberately put together like this so that we can see this. Just think about how different they are. You've got Jairus, who had a name, who was kind of a power broker, an upstanding member of the community. And then you have this woman whose name Mark does not know, who's just a face in the crowd. You've got Jairus, who was a religious insider, and then this woman who, because of this condition where she's bleeding, is a social outcast. In Jewish law, when you had any kind of issue of blood like this, you were supposed to stay away. Stay away from the temple. Stay away from people. Stay on the other side of the street. Stay away because you're unclean. Not suitable to be in public. Not suitable to come in contact with people. And as a result, a social outcast. You know, Jesus spoke against this all the time, but they assumed that if you had a medical problem like this, it was because of your moral depravity. Jesus, on several occasions, said, no, that's not it at all. But that was the stigma that she lived with. You know, as far as everybody could see, at least on the outside, Jairus was very obedient to the law, but man, this woman, by pushing through the crowd like she was, being in a public place, surrounded by people jostling and bustling and pushing her way through to Jesus, she made everyone around her contaminated in the eyes of these people. And so, very different backgrounds, different, totally different, you know, coming from completely different places, and yet with two things in common that Jesus really appreciated. One, they both recognized they had something hopelessly broken they could not fix. Just the humility and the awareness, I'm confronted with something that I could never handle by myself. It's way beyond my ability. And they both felt Jesus could do something about it. It wasn't pretty, they weren't perfect, but they had these two things right here. I'm desperately broken, and Jesus can help me. And when Jesus saw just that, he responded. He saw their faith and was willing to respond. So just think about that picture. You know, we talked about how, you know, Jairus had a foxhole faith. Jairus was probably reluctantly putting his trust in Christ. It was about as weak as possible. And you think about this woman. This woman basically viewed Jesus like he was an electrical outlet. Like, if I plug into him, I'll get the juice I need to be healed. There's clearly no interest in engaging him. She's just trying to get in and get out. You know, you think about Notre Dame. I'm not a Notre Dame fan, but I guess when they, before they go on the field, they touch this banner. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to basically channel all that tradition and the past heroes of the field on the past, and they're trying to get a little burst before they go play football. At Clemson, they touch, I forget, Howard's Rock, I think that's what that is. Not very effective, I don't think, but you get the, you know, not lately at least. You know, that's, what is that? It's superstition, really. But isn't that what this woman does? The only difference is she didn't touch a banner. She didn't touch a rock. She touched Jesus. That's who she looked to get better. And when she did, it says, immediately the flow of her blood was dried up and she felt in her body. Imagine that. Just, I can tell I'm healed. And so this woman who was so bleak, maybe just is willing to hope now, wow, what's it going to be like? Her mind must have been racing. What doors are going to open to me? What kind of amazing things will I be able to do that I never thought I'd be able to do now that I'm better? But before she could get... much more excited, she heard something she did not want to hear. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, he turned around and said, "Who touched me?" He's like, hold up, stops, rotates. Who did this? Somebody touch me. Who touched me? You know, and if you're her, you're looking for a rock to crawl under at that point. And I know what this feels like. Actually, me and my buddy were near the Pennsylvania-Ohio border. We were driving down the road and we saw the cooling tower of a nuclear power plant. And I'm a curious sort, so was my buddy. And the tower was right next to a parking lot. The parking lot was empty and it was a Sunday and there were no barriers, no warning signs. We thought, yeah, what can it hurt to just sneak in and just take a look and then sneak out again? It's going to be okay. So we did. We took a right into this parking lot, headed for the cooling tower. And then on our left, we noticed driving very quickly toward us was a Humvee, which turned out to have two soldiers in it in full military gear. At that point, we wanted to leave, but that wasn't going to happen. They were like, we need to talk. So something like that vibe, right? Like you thought you were going to get away with this, but that's not what's going to happen. Yeah, Jesus is not going to let this go. The disciples are like, what are you talking about? The crowd's pressing in on you, Jesus, and you say, who touched me? You know, the better question would be like, who didn't touch you? What are you talking about? But Jesus insists, no, someone did, and I'm going to find out who. And he's literally looking around to see the woman who had done this. And it says in Luke that he found her. I don't know if like there was an eye contact, like, oh yeah. But whatever happened, she was busted. He knew, and she knew he knew. And so she comes up to him, you know, blubbering, tears down her face, fearing and trembling, aware of what happened to her. She came and fell down before him. Just think about, she knows. She knows that what she's done as a woman who's unclean would be like hugging someone in an elevator that you don't know and coughing all over them. It was that bad. She knows. And she knows it's she hasn't just like pushed through the crowd. She has touched a man in public, a teacher. She knows all that. She knows exactly what she's done. And she just tells him the whole truth. I was sick. I was desperate. I didn't know where to turn, and I went to you, and I wanted to be well, and I am well. I can't believe it. And she just loses it in front of Jesus. And again, you know, you think about what he could have said. He could have said, okay, so you stole a healing instead of asking for one. You pushed through this whole crowd in your condition. Do you realize everybody here is unclean? He could have totally said things like that. He could have said a lot of things, but he didn't. What he said was, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. Daughter, such a tender term, only place in all the Gospels this word is ever used. It's a very affectionate term. I was thinking about how much I love my two girls. There's some kind of emotion connected to being a dad, that there's a depth of affection there. That's what he's conveying. He's like, I know that there's a little girl dying. I just want you to know that right now you matter more to me than anything else. And he just affirms her. This idea of going in peace, it's like, that's really a sense of shalom. It's really like, it's okay. You haven't done anything wrong. I see you. I care about you. I'm glad you came to get help. That's what this is about. He really wants to slow down and kind of plant a flag in this moment and tell this girl, good job. What you did here was a good thing. And so, what are we learning about Jesus? Wow, compassionate. You just don't really think that his posture towards you, doesn't matter what your background is, when he sees you in pain, his posture is compassion. the idea that he's not just compassionate, but he is powerful and actually able to help in ways that are meaningful. That he's got, 12 years, uncurable condition. No, he can do something there. The idea, too, that nobody, whose daughter was this woman? Jairus's daughter had a dad, but who was advocating for her? Nobody. Nobody but Jesus, right? And he's, read the Gospels over and over again. No one sides with people, but Jesus says, now that's my guy. I'm going to stay with this person. But the other thing that we're seeing here, and this is what both of these episodes are really about, is he really values even the teeniest bit of faith. What was the whole point of this? Why does he stop the train? Why does he shut everything down and say, we're not going to do anything until I talk to the person who touched me? It wasn't to humiliate her. That's not what he was trying to do. It wasn't about humiliating her. He could have winked at her. Here's your discreet mercy, just kind of slipped on to the next thing. He did not do that. He wanted everyone to see, hey, everybody, right here, this woman, in her desperation, she had the courage to come to me, and that's good. That's the whole point. He's trying to call attention to her example. And here's the thing about her example, and this is true with Jairus too. She had enough trust to be willing to act. Okay, so you think, okay, what would that look like? This idea that, okay, do you have enough knowledge of Jesus and enough trust that you'd be willing to move toward him? There's a scene in the Old Testament where these people are bitten by a snake, and Moses makes a bronze serpent. God tells him to, and he puts it on a pole, and the snake is held above the Jews for them to see. And it says that when they looked up at the snake, they were healed of their snake bite. That just laying there sick, just lifting your eyes off the ground and looking at that bronze serpent was enough to heal you. And Jesus in John 3, he says, coming to me is like that. Can you just lift your eyes? Just that much, just a trust that would be willing to do that. That's the kind of faith that Jesus is celebrating. That's what he's calling attention to, that kind of faith. All right. Meanwhile, oh, yes. Jairus's daughter is dying. We forgot about that. While he was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue saying, and this is what nobody wanted to hear, in this delay, Jairus, your daughter has died. Don't trouble the teacher anymore. And so the situation goes from bad to impossible. It makes you wonder, Jairus had a little bit of faith. Is it going to die now that his daughter's died? It certainly died when you think about these guys, the people coming to him. They're like, we're wasting our time. Let's just go home. This is terrible. If you're thinking about the woman, she's like, oh my God, I can't believe the delay that I caused has cost this girl her life. And Jairus, talk about the agony. Just like, oh, I can't believe we got interrupted. And I think God knows when the curveballs in life bring our faith to the breaking point. And they do bring our faith to the breaking point. And in moments like that, I think we can ask him to step in and even help us with our faith. I think that's what God would want to do. Look what he does here. Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, he's looking at Jairus. He can see Jairus melting down. He says to the synagogue official, don't be afraid any longer, but believe. Now, Jairus already believed. He believed Jesus could heal his kid. But Jesus is saying, go on believing. I'm going to walk with you. Let's go to your house. Don't give up on this. I think for some of us here, that's what God would be saying. It's as hard as it's ever been, but go on believing. And so he allowed no one to accompany him except for Peter and James and John, the brother of James, kind of his inner circle. They came to the house of the synagogue official. He saw a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing, and entering in, he said to them, "Why make a commotion and weep? The child hasn't died, but is asleep." And they began laughing at him. And so, yeah, that may seem like a strange thing to say when, you know, the funeral preparations are happening, people are weeping, the little girl is dead. But when you're the guy who can tell nature to shush and someone passes away, that's never final. Anyone that passes away is someone that God can rise again. It's as if they're asleep. And so despite the fact that a bunch of people who probably never wanted him there in the first place were laughing at him, it says that he put them out, took the child's father and mother and his own companions, and he entered the room where the child was. And taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha, come." Now that sounds like some kind of like Harry Potter spell. But this is Peter, right? Peter's co-writing with Mark. Peter was in the room, and he's like, these are the words. These are the very words that Jesus spoke in that moment. Not a magic spell. This is translated from Aramaic, which was Jesus' native tongue. It was a simple command. Just like the command he spoke to calm the sea, he spoke, and this little girl rose from the dead. Powerful. So immediately she gets up and begins to walk, for she was 12 years old, and immediately they were completely astounded. Immediately. And he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this, and he said that something should be given to her to eat. Okay. So give her a sandwich and keep it on the down low. That's pretty much the way the episode ends. And there you go. Those are your two episodes. Now, I just want to finish by thinking about a few things here. What about Jesus? What can we learn? We've seen that he's compassionate. We've seen that he cares about outsiders. We've seen that he has great power. But I wonder, when we think about our situation, do we believe that he can and will set hopeless and broken things right? Some of us are sitting here and we're in a very deep foxhole. We're facing things that don't look like they're going to get right anytime soon. And the idea that we're going to bump into Jesus on the shore of Hoover Reservoir is just not like, you know, the idea that I'm going to have this kind of powerful reversal of fortune because of an encounter with Jesus. A lot of us really wonder if that ever happens. And I have to say, I don't have time to get into this. There are credible accounts of miraculous healings, even in our own day. We don't really feature this very often in our church, but it does happen. You can go Google this, one who took up her bed and walked. It's about a woman named Barbara Comiskey. This is an article in Christianity Today. It's a very well-researched article. It's been written about by many people since, where this woman, Barbara Comiskey, who's doing just fine today, had a very terrible condition back in in the early 80s. It was a really terrible case of MS, where she was just, you know, collapsed lungs, atrophied muscles, unable to function, bedridden for a year, and then instantly on her feet and healthy again. There are other examples of this. You can read in missions literature, ask around in our church. There are times when God powerfully heals people. But for as many stories like that as we have, even though, yes, it does happen, we also have many people that do not get healed. Yeah. You know, there's someone you love, or you yourself are facing an illness, and it just, you know, you watch them slip away. What about that? Well, I think a key thing about these stories to remember, the main reason why Jesus is doing miracles in the Gospels is to help us realize that this future kingdom that he's coming to bring, this kingdom where there's no sickness, no pain, no broken relationships, you know, love and vitality and life forever, that kingdom is coming, and his miracles are a glimpse into that future kingdom. They're like a down payment. They're a way of Jesus saying, now this is going to happen. This kingdom is at hand, and yet when it comes in its fullness, you will experience what real health, real vitality, real life is all about. And just as a quick aside, is there any evidence that these miracles we're reading about ever happened? There's actually quite a bit of evidence. There are witnesses outside the Bible that talk about Jesus. Everyone we have agrees, if when they talk about him, that he did miracles. Josephus, the Talmud, the Jewish, they all agree that guy was doing some strange works. What they disagree on is where he got his power. Most of them attribute his power to sorcery or Satan or something. But something was happening. And that something was love from God to affirm to us his kingdom is coming. And so faith now, hope in the future, that's part of what these miracles are about. And that's part of what we have to remember as we're reading this. This is really about boosting our excitement about this future kingdom. And what can we learn about faith? Well, it doesn't seem like the amount of faith matters. Think about what we've seen. Jairus reluctantly goes to someone he really didn't want to be with. This woman treats Jesus like an electrical outlet. That's okay. The faith they had was weak, absolutely weak, low, tainted by fear, undeniably. Not as strong as the kind of faith we can see in other people, but it was enough. It was enough. Just that teeny bit. You're sitting here wondering what could God do with the state I'm in? These stories teach it does not take much faith for God to work. And if you think, you're kind of reading into this, Jesus explicitly taught this. Truly I say to you, he said, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, that's like a millimeter wide, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Just a little bit of faith gets the ear of God. And when God is mobilized, anything can happen. Here's what matters. What matters is the object of your faith. You think about this guy, he picked the right chair, right? He can actually lean back on it and have it not just crash into splinters on the floor, because the object of his faith, the thing that he trusts, is able to bear his weight. That's a good object of faith. The Cleveland Browns are not a good object of faith, right? If you're trusting that they're going to win a Super Bowl or make the playoffs or have a winning record or draft wisely or pick the... time to put your faith somewhere else, right? I know that's hard. Now you can stay in there with your Browns, but you get my point. My point is the faith can be weak, but if the faith is well placed, that's all that matters. That's all that matters in these stories, is that we're able to open our eyes and say, yes, Jesus. Jesus has what I need. And so I realize a lot of us were wealthy, well-fed, comfortable people. And there are things, as you sit here now, that have been working for you really well. Maybe you finally reached an income level where you can do what you want. Maybe you finally lowered your golf score and you could, you know, go out and feel better about hanging out with your friends. Maybe that bottle in front of you isn't so bad and it's been working for you. Or some other thing, maybe a relationship God put in your life has just, it's just really, in an enduring way, really met your needs. But I wonder, as solid as some of these things are that we've put our trust in, can they bear the weight of eternity? You know, you're going to hit a spot where life will push you past anything that can help you. And when you get there, and we all will get there, what are you going to put your trust in? Okay? What's going to be able to bear the weight of eternity? The whole point of these stories is to appeal to you. Pick the object of your faith carefully. And if you think it through, look into the evidence, the place to put it is in Christ. So, Lord, I thank you when we call out to you, knowing that our faith isn't even close, that you're willing to stand next to us and say, let's keep going and keep on believing. I know that that's a prayer according to your will. So I pray for anybody who's just feels like they just don't have any gas in the tank. Help them offer that prayer up to you. And I pray too, if anyone's kind of written themselves off as somebody who's too far gone to ever be received by you, I pray they'd be encouraged to take the faith they have and to call out to you, God. Amen.